This is the Scottish Football Citizen, bringing you the best of Scottish football from the past. I'm Andy Kerr, and this week we're delving into the archives of the Scottish Football Museum to bring you an interview with former Scottish broadcaster Dougie Donnelly. As soon as you hear his voice, you'll immediately be transported back to the days of Sports Scene and Grandstand. Before we get started, here's this week's dose of trivia for you. Lyndon Dykes recently scored 4 goals in 4 consecutive games for the Scotland men's national team. Who was the last Scotland player to achieve this feat before Dykes? We'll give you the answer at the end of the podcast. As a sports broadcaster, Dougie Donnelly is someone who needs no introduction in Scotland. Born in Glasgow on the 7th of June 1953, Dougie was raised in Rutherglen and followed in his grandfather's footsteps by becoming a fan of Clyde FC. He attended Hamilton Academy and went on to study at the University of Strathclyde's Law School. Dougie started his career in broadcasting with Radio Clyde in the 1970s, where he presented several shows and went on to appear on various TV shows such as Sports Scene and Grandstand. On Grandstand, he became known to viewers all across the UK, where he covered sports such as football, rugby, bowls and golf, to name but a few. He also covered 4 Commonwealth Games, 4 Summer Olympics and 3 Winter Olympics. Listeners of a younger demographic may remember his appearances in TV advertisements for the furniture store Stirling in Tillicoutray, Clackmannanshire, or even a mention of him in the BBC Scotland comedy show Burniston, which featured the Dougie Donnelly action figure in one sketch.
A Dougie Donnelly action figure!
These days, Dougie has retired from his TV work and appears as an after-dinner speaker host at many events such as the annual Scottish Football Hall of Fame induction ceremony. Without further ado, let's hear from the man himself.
Even before that, my grandfather was a gate checker at Shawfield. We lived in Rutherglen, and he used to take me down to the games, both the first team games and the reserve team games, because he worked every Saturday, obviously. And so I saw the reserves as often as I saw the first team. And I suppose that when you think about it now, they were quite reasonable crowds we used to get for reserve games at Shawfield. You know, 1,000 or 1,500 or something like that. And I always remember, and the days before the comprehensive radio coverage that we have now, after the reserve team game would be over and we'd all hang about at the front of the stand waiting for the tannoy to announce the first team result, and then there'd be a little cheer went up or a great groan went up if the first team had lost to Easter Road or somewhere. So I remember that very clearly from being 6, 7, 8 years old. And then later, as you say, I went on and I became a ball boy for a couple of seasons, I think, and it coincided with a great spell for Clyde, because in 66-67, well, Celtic were winning everything in sight. Clyde actually had a terrific season as well and finished third in the league as a part-time team. And I remember being absolutely heartbroken, because at that time the UEFA Cup, which we should have qualified for, was actually called the Intercities Fairs Cup. And it had started, I think, as a tournament for cities that had trade fairs of one sort or another. Anyway, the rule was that you could only have one club from each city. And since Celtic had won the league, Aberdeen had won the cup, so they had been beaten by Celtic in the cup final, they went into the Cup Winners' Cup. And therefore Rangers, who were second in the league, went into the Intercities Fairs Cup. One team, one city, Clyde were bombed out. And it was, our only chance of European football. So I remember being heartbroken about that.
Can you tell us why you decided to support Clyde?
I suppose through my grandfather, really, through being taken when I was very young. And also, everyone supported Rangers or Celtic, as is the case in the west of Scotland. And I must have, even at that early age, thought, no, I don't want to just run with a pack and support the same team everybody else does. And I had this affinity with Clyde early on. And I still think that it's relatively easy to be an Old Firm supporter. I wouldn't say I've had more respect for supporters of other clubs, but I think it is generally fairly easy to support the Old Firm. It's not so easy to support Clyde or Brechin City or Cowdenbeath or Partick Thistle.
Who did you used to go to games with?
With my grandfather. Then obviously I started going on my own, going with my mates, going down to Shawfield, or with my dad to midweek games at Hampden. Always when my dad used to take me to the international matches, we used to drive over from Rutherglen and park up at the back of King's Park and walked down the hill into what was the old Celtic end. And I remember very clearly watching cup semi-finals and international matches and so on a Wednesday night, which is always a great thrill. There's always, even to this day, I still get a buzz out of floodlight matches. I don't know what it is. There's just something about a night match with the lights on. The atmosphere somehow is completely different. Mm-hmm. So I remember that very clearly, and collecting all the programmes and all the things that, you know, kids do at that age.
In the area where you lived, did a lot of people support Clyde? Or?
I suppose there were a fair number, yeah. I mean, there still is a Rutherglen Clyde supporters club. I mean, going back to when we weren't allowed into Europe in 67, one of the excuses, if you like, that we tried to put up was that Clyde weren't a Glasgow team at all, we were a Rutherglen team, because the actual city boundary actually cut right through the middle of Sheffield. It was quite odd, but they wouldn't have that, and they said, no, you're members of the Glasgow Association, you're a Glasgow club. But no, Rutherglen was, there was a fair amount of Clyde support and Rutherglen local team and all that, I suppose, but still buses and buses and buses leaving for Parkhead and Ibrox every week.
Where did you stand at Sheffield?
Where did I stand? In the main stand, really, I suppose. Sometimes in the farce. I sold programmes as well. I was the PA announcer. I did all sorts of jobs. So there weren't very many games where I just went along and just sat and watched the game. I was usually a ball boy or selling programmes, or even a couple of occasions helping out in the tea bar, because everybody knew me and knew my grandfather. And so I said, we're short up in Maggie's tea bar, go and, you know, serve the pies and Bovril for a wee while. So I did all of those things. And I have this memory of Sheffield, and the overwhelming memory, I suppose, is that huge black and white tote board behind the Rutherglen end goal. Because obviously Sheffield was also a Greyhound stadium, and sometimes get bigger crowds for the Dugs on a Friday night than it did for the football. But it was a strange football ground. It wasn't a particularly satisfactory ground, because the pitch was a long way from the spectators, because the dog track was in between. And this huge tote board, which I never ever understood. I mean, I'm not into betting even now particularly. I never knew how this board worked. I presume numbers flicked up and down on it, but that's always part of the memory I have of Sheffield as it was.
Was your grandfather quite involved with
Clyde? Not really, not in the playing side at all. No, he was a school janitor, my grandfather, and I think it was just a sort of part-time job for him on a Saturday afternoon, a Wednesday night. No, he wasn't involved at all in the playing side. But I mean, he obviously was a football fan, and both he and my dad encouraged me enormously to play.
What was your most memorable game as a Clyde supporter?
There were a few that season. We were third in the league, where we played absolutely sensational football. I remember beating Kilmarnock 4-5-0 and Harry Hood scoring an absolute wonder goal, a volley from outside the box. We had a lot of big wins. I remember beating Hearts before our 5. I suppose probably the most memorable was the cup semi-final against Celtic. Obviously that season Celtic had that fabulous Lisbon Lions team and were on their way to winning everything, but we played them in the cup semi-final and drew 0-0 on the Saturday, which was actually a great result, and then went back in the Wednesday and lost the replay, unfortunately 3-0. But I suppose that Saturday, and there was a decent crowd at Hampden obviously, and just being there thinking this is Clyde in the cup semi-final, 90 minutes away from being in the cup final. Because I was too young to remember the Clyde team that won the cup a couple of times in the 50s, but so that would have been something, but not many teams beat Celtic that season.
You mentioned, kind of covered this in the last question, but what would you say is the club's greatest achievement?
In some ways, the greatest achievement is actually staying alive, because I mean, the club has pretty well always been in crisis. I mean, even getting back to the 60s when I went, the crowds were never big. The traditional support around Rutherglen and the East End had all been decanted out to places like Easterhousen, Drumchapel and East Kilbride. The old East End, all the tenements were being pulled down. And I think Clyde lost a lot of fans through simply people moving away. So we never had big crowds. We were always part-time, never had any money for big transfers or anything like that. And then, obviously, then went down the leagues and played second division up to the first, back to the second. And then that terrible time when Sheffield closed in 86, and we shared initially with our hated rivals at Partick Thistle, and then we were out at Douglas Park. And for a long time, it really did look as if Clyde were going to fold altogether. And then, thankfully, we managed to get things together and move to Broadwood, and the club got a bit of a new lease of life, and hopefully, as we speak, are about to be promoted into the First Division, which we need to be, obviously, and we've got the stadium now. I think there's a lot of latent support around Cumbernauld, Kilsyth, Kirkintilloch, all around that area that might well become Clyde supporters if we get a little bit of success. So, in terms of the greatest achievement, really, genuinely, just there still being a Clyde football club is not to be sniffed at. Playing-wise, winning promotion a couple of times under Craig Brown was great, but really, sadly, not an awful lot since the 60s.
Can you tell us who some of your favourite Clyde players were?
John McHugh, the sweeper, and John was a sweeper when sweepers were still a fairly new development, and I played centre half myself. So, and John was a smashing player, and didn't get a Scotland cap. He was in the squad for a couple of games, I remember, but never got a cap. But I always thought John was a terrific player. Harry Hood, obviously, was a very clever inside forward. Joe Gilroy, great striker. With two speedy wingers in the days when we had such things, Graham McFarlane and Sammy Hastings. I can recite the team, you know, Wright, Glasgow, Mulheron, Anderson, Fraser, McHugh, McFarlane, Hood, Gilroy, Stewart and Hastings. And it was in the days when you used to learn these. And I mean, I could probably do the Rangers and Celtic teams as well, which would be sort of what, Haffy, Mackay and Kennedy, Creran, McNeil and Peacock, you know, so are Richie, Shearer, Galdo, Greg McKinnon, Baxter. It was in the Evening Times on a Friday night, tomorrow's teams, and the teams never changed very much. You know, if you had a right half who was injured, the reserve right half came in, so it was just one for one. I mean, there weren't squads and teams changing, so I mean, kids of my age, you used to learn them off with a lot more interest than you ever learned poetry at school, but I can still recite half a dozen teams from that era.
Some of the ones Claire's mentioned here are people like Danny McGrain and Pat Nevin.
That's right, that was a little bit later on again, obviously. Danny McGrain, who was a cousin of the Celtic, Danny McGrain, who was a smashing little player, a real midfield dynamo in the kind of Billy Bremner mould. And Danny sadly suffered a fractured skull in a match, I think at Falkirk, if I remember rightly. And he looked as if he was going to have to give the game up completely. I think he did come back, but it was always kind of against medical advice, so poor Danny had to give the game up. But he was a terrific little player. Pat Nevin obviously was stolen from us for $90,000 by Chelsea. He was worth far more than that. Steve Archibald obviously was at Sheffield as well around that time, and good club players like Brian Ahern, who I think possibly still holds the record number of attendances. And Brian again was an inspiring player and captain. We've always had guys like that, good one-club men, and later on Ross McFarlane, who played for 10 or 12 years, never scored a goal. And then Keith Knox, of course, quite recently, who was a postie in Stranraer. And I dread to think of the miles that Knoxie must have covered coming up and down from Stranraer for training and for matches, and still been up at 4 in the morning to go and deliver mail. So that to me, these are the guys that are the real unsung heroes and deserve big testimonials, because they never made very much money and they gave so much to the club.
Can you tell us about how you felt when Sheffield closed, and did you go to the last game?
Oh, I was there, yeah. I was, April 1986 against Alloa, and we won 4-2, thankfully. And I was introduced to the park. They brought back a lot of the old players and everyone out at half-time and took a bow. I had a kind of mixed feelings about it, because although it had been home and I had seen so many hundreds of games there, I never liked it particularly as a football stadium. Excuse me. Sheffield was always a dog track, which doubled as a football stadium, and the atmosphere was never as good as it might have been, just because the crowd was so far away. So at that time we were very hopeful of having a new stadium fairly quickly, so I think there was a case, well, that's a shame that we're leaving Sheffield, but you know, there are better times ahead. We didn't know that it was going to be what, 8 years before we finally managed to get a new stadium. So yeah, mixed feelings about it, but it was an emotional night, and thankfully we won, which was a good way to end, and the usual sort of people digging up bits of the turf and stealing bits of the stand and so on.
Did you steal anything?
I didn't, of course not.
What was Broadwood like in comparison in the stadium?
Broadwood's wonderful. It doesn't have a lot of character in the way that modern stadia don't. I mean, I don't like Murrayfield. They're great sports stadia, but you could put them down anywhere in the world, obviously. There's nothing particularly traditional or Scottish about them. And Broadwood's a wonderful modern stadium. It's a big playing surface. Hopefully we'll get the fourth stand up fairly soon, because the planning permission is now in place. And then it'll be terrific. I mean, that's only three-sided just now. It's a modern football stadium, like Forth Bank or like any of the other new ones that have been built recently. And they don't have great tradition and atmosphere yet. Mm-hmm. But for Clyde, it's a huge improvement on what we had before.
Obviously you work on a Saturday, do you never get to go to Clyde games anymore?
I was there on Tuesday night to see us beating the Thistle 1-0. I don't get to as many games as I would like. I mean, I'm one of the few that are delighted when games are off on a Saturday because of the weather, because that means there'll be a midweek replay or rescheduling, and usually I can get to that. I mean, if I see Clyde six or eight times in a season, that's as many as I do. I'm not really a supporter. A supporter is someone who goes through thick and thin. So I'm not really a supporter, I suppose, in those sense and in those terms. But no, they're still my team, without a doubt.
And in your opinion, just to finish off, and Clive, what do you think the future holds for smaller Scottish clubs like them?
I'm actually quite optimistic because I think in Scotland, the Old Firm will always be dominant, always have been. But I actually think now the financial gulf is so enormous that I actually believe Rangers and Celtic are actually over the horizon. I don't think anyone will ever win the league again other than the Old Firm. Somebody might come through and win the cup because you can do that. But I really do believe that if you look at Rangers and Celtic, 60,000 every home game, the next best supported, let's say Hearts, if they're going well, who might get 15, Aberdeen, Hibs, they're okay, well, maybe getting 12, 15,000. So that's, if you think every home game, there's a difference of 45,000 times a tenner, or whatever the admission price happens to be. So every home game, the gap, which is already enormous, is growing by that much. So how can, you know, any other team ever compete? So there's an argument now, of course, if the Old Firm ever leave for a European league, what would happen to Scottish football? Would it become the Irish League and a joke? Or would you then have suddenly a very competitive league with 8 or 10 teams with a chance of winning it? And as Hibs proved in the first division last year, if you're winning, the fans will turn out. I mean, Hibs had 15,000 seen playing Stranraer. And it just goes to show that if a team's winning, the fans will turn out. It doesn't matter who the opposition is. So you kind of cling to the thought that, well, it might not be the worst thing if we lose the Old Firm. And then again, reality sets in and you realise it really would be a bit of a backwater and you wouldn't have the quality of players that we see at the moment wearing Rangers or Celtic strips. But for teams like Clyde, I think we will find our level. I would love to think that one day we'll be a Premier club. I suspect that a decent First Division club attracting 5,000 or 6,000 to Broadwood would be fine. I think we could live at that level. I just want to see the game surviving as a professional sport in Scotland, and I think the Premier League has to go up to 16, if not 18 teams, because I think it's absolutely vital that the Falkirks and the Raith Rovers and the Inverness Callies and the St Mirrens and even the Clydes are encouraged to be full-time and employ young football players and thereby have the game survive as an entertainment and for the international team to thrive. I don't think it's a good thing at all that Rangers and Celtic play one Scot or two Scots on the side. For all that 60,000 people turn out to watch it, I think that's a very short-term view.
Mm-hmm. If we can move on now to your illustrious career. One of your other interests when you were growing up, you were a law student, mm-hmm. and you were also interested in the music industry. Can you tell us how close you came to pursuing that as a career?
I came pretty close, I suppose. I left university without my degree. I sort of went back and finished it later, which is another story. But I went into an entertainment agency at that time, and I was promoting rock bands, bringing up rock bands from the south and putting them into colleges for a tour and doing all that sort of thing. And was offered a couple of jobs. Gary Glitter's manager offered me a job. Jeff Hanlon, great guy. He offered me a job working with him in London, promoting the bands. And I got another job offer from Mel Bush, who was a huge promoter at the time, and Harvey Goldsmith as well. So, I mean, there was a lot of... because I did so much in Glasgow, and we managed bands and did a bit of agency and so on. And at that time, I really thought that was going to be my career. And then I bumped into Andy Park, who was the programme controller at Radio Clyde, which was just going on the air at that time. This is mid-70s. And I interviewed him actually for the student television station, that's what it was, because they knew I knew a bit about music, so therefore I got to interview Andy about this new radio station. And he ended up not quite offering me a job, but encouraging me to think about it and to make audition tapes for him, which I did, and I sent it in, and he sent it back and said, "This is absolute rubbish, you'll have to stop doing this and stop doing this and try to do a bit more of that." So I then did another audition tape, and that was a bit better. And I think on the third one, he finally gave in and gave me a couple of shows to do. And suddenly, from being in the sort of management side of the music business, I was a DJ, which I'd never thought of being, really. I'd done some DJing at university, but it was just a bit of fun, you know, have a few drinks and hopefully become more attractive to women. So that's how it started, really. And then suddenly I was in radio and it went quite well, and I got the morning show, which I had for a long time, and went to speak at a Burns supper. Funnily enough, not far from where I live now, although I didn't know the place then, and met a BBC producer who had heard me on the radio and said, "Well, you obviously know sport, because we talked about sport all night. He said, have you thought about doing some telly sport?" So I went in and auditioned the following Wednesday. I think the dinner was on the Friday. I auditioned the following Wednesday, interviewed Derek Parlane, They interviewed about six, or auditioned about six different people as potential match reporters, presenters, and we all had to do an imaginary match report from some game that we'd supposedly seen, and then turn round and interview Derek Parlin, who was at that time obviously a big name with Rangers. So the six of us did it, and I think a couple of us got some work out of it, and that's how the television career started.
Early on in your television career, you were doing match reports from grounds. Can you tell us how that worked?
When you think about it now, when everything is so high-tech, but it really was pretty primitive at that time. We're talking 1978 was when my career started. March 1978, my first game, I was sent to Broomfield to see Airdrie against Dundee. And the deal was that you went along to the game and then had to be back live in the studio for the final score programme at the end of Grandstand. So you were on the air at 4:45, 4:50. So obviously if you're at Broomfield, or even worse if you're at somewhere like Somerset Park, you have to leave at half time. You know, you don't get to see the game. So it's a bit of a con in a way that, you know, you're back reporting on this game you'd only seen half of. So I left Broomfield with, I think, half an hour to go. And from memory, and someone somewhere will check this and find it's complete rubbish, but my memory is that I left with a score, I think, 3-1 to Airdrie. So it's my debut on television, obviously, so I'm terribly nervous and uptight. All the way back in the taxi, I'm writing my little script, and good day for Airdrie, and three good goals, and dominated the match. And of course, you get back into the office, and it's finished 3-3. I'm sure it was 3-3. Anyway, certainly Dundee came back, and Airdrie didn't win it. So suddenly your script's completely out the window, and you have to redo it. But that's the way it worked in those days. And I remember also Fraser Elder, who was also one of the reporting team at that time, going to a match at Somerset Park, and left at 0-0 at half time, and it finished 7-0. He missed all seven goals; they were all scored in the second half. But that's the way it worked. So we did those, and then I started doing a bit of presenting. I think my first presentation job was the November of that year, 78. It was a Wednesday night programme, and it was a European night. And I think Rangers Juventus was the big game. There would obviously be other Scottish clubs playing, but our big sort of OB match was Rangers Juventus in November 78. But it was pretty primitive when you think about it. VT runs, which everyone now knows about, you know, when you actually play on the videotape. Now it's instantaneous. You say the commentator is Rob McLean, and they're on the tape. But in those days, it had a 10-second run-up time. So you had to give the director, or actually the production assistant, a run word to run the VT. So I would say that my run might be Ibrox or Parkhead or Jockstein, whatever them. And as soon as the PA heard that word, she would hit the tape, and I then had another 10 seconds to talk to hit it exactly. So that was a little bit of a craft which you had to learn. And things like the league tables, there weren't all these wonderful computer graphics we take for granted now. This literally was a music stand with a little magnetic board on it with little magnetic letters and numbers, which never sat quite straight. There was always one a little bit askew, and you know, one would fall off, and you know, and that's where the joke came from about Falkirk, and the F at the beginning of Falkirk would fall off, and somebody reputedly said, "I'm sorry, but F and Falkirk." I don't know whether that ever happened, but it's quite a good line, isn't it? But it really was. It was that primitive in those days. I suppose presenting is easier now than it was then because of this 10-second run-up thing. And because just the business wasn't as advanced technically as it is now.
Mm. Sports Scene's probably the programme you're best known for in terms of Scottish football. Can you tell us how you made the move to present in Sports Scene and what it was like? Were you working with Archie at first?
I was, yep. Archie was the main presenter and commentator. I mean, he did both jobs. Gordon Hewitt, who became a good friend, Professor Gordon Hewitt, who's now an extremely high-flying business consultant. Gordon was a good lad, and Gordon taught me quite a lot. But obviously there are people throughout your career that have been very helpful, and Gordon was certainly one. But no, I remember it being... When you get to present something that you've watched for so long, there's an extra buzz. It was like the first time I went on Radio Clyde having listened to the station, or the first time I presented Grandstand. And you know, the music's playing, and it suddenly kind of hits you amidst all this concentration that you're trying to maintain. God, I'm about to present this programme I've watched all those years. And it was a bit like that with Sports Scene as well. Then a theme tune plays, you know, God, it's me this time. And that's a huge buzz. Very nerve-wracking, but encouraged, because I mean, they felt I was good enough. I mean, I'd done match reporting for 6 months, half a season really. And they said, "No, we'd like you to present the programme. I think you could do that." And I've always felt that my radio experience was a huge factor in it, because I think having done radio for so long, you develop the ability to talk without a script and without autocue. It really is all ad-libbed, and virtually all of the broadcasting I now do is exactly that. Sport is. I mean, you don't very often get the luxury of scripting sport. You're live and you're reacting to events. You're trying to find the right words. You're trying to hold it together technically. You're trying to interview people and make ask sensible questions and listen to the answers all the time, also listening to the director telling you in your ear what's happening next. And I think I've always felt that if you're not also a slave to the autocue, that you're able to react to events as they happen, that's a plus.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, people ask how you do it and how you become good at it, and I, in all modesty, I genuinely don't know. It's not something I ever trained for or wanted to do. I'm not a journalist. I've got no journalistic training. I've never been on any sort of course, television course or anything else. It's just something that a knack that I was born with and didn't know I had. And I've been enormously lucky, hugely fortunate that I was going to be a lawyer who liked music and sport, like, you know, a million other people. And suddenly I found that, gosh, I can do this, and I've got this wonderful job where I travel the world watching sport. Very, very lucky.
Can you tell us the story in your own words about Archie getting caught reading the newspaper?
Archie will never speak to me again. This was in the early days, or my early days, when Archie and I used to co-present Sportscene on a Saturday night. Well, Archie presented it and I was the kind of number two on it. And at that time, the format of Sportscene was Scottish match, middle item, English match. That's what we had. The programme, I think, was only half an hour or 40 minutes long. So Archie was, and I think is, a football man. I mean, he has a passing interest in other sports, but unlike me, who's almost as passionate about things like golf and rugby and snooker as I am about football, Archie never had any interest in anything else, really. So on a Saturday night, he was so involved in the Scottish match and so involved in the English match, but the middle item, which would be club rugby or swimming or underwater volleyball, whatever it was, which I usually introduced or whatever, Archie had no interest in that. So when that came on, he would start muttering about, ah, they're making a cup of tea now, what's all this about, nobody wants to see this. And we used to get the early edition of the Sunday papers delivered to the studio on the Saturday night, and there was one famous night when the Scottish game had been a cracker and he was really enthusiastic, and then on came what admittedly was a very bad club rugby match and a horrible wet afternoon with three men and a dog watching it. And poor Archie was completely disinterested, so he picked up the early edition of the Sunday paper and started reading it. And I'm watching it because I've introduced it and I've got to say something about it at the end. And suddenly, as occasionally happened in those days, the videotape went down for whatever reason. I don't know whether the tape snapped or a machine switched itself off. But anyway, suddenly screen goes blank, and what happens in this situation? Obviously everyone reacts in a panic. Studio lights come up and camera one, and there's Archie sitting there reading the paper. And I mean, I've seen the tape, it's hysterical. And he suddenly looks up, realises he's on, and the paper goes right over his left shoulder. He looks at the camera with this kind of stupid grin and has no idea what to say. So he turns to me and says, "Now, Doogie." Wonderful memory. Sorry, Archie.
To talk a bit more about presentation, can you define your job for us and what skills it requires?
Oh, that's a difficult one. What skills does it require? This is going to, it sounds very immodest when you start talking about what you can do, but you've asked me. I think number one has to be knowledge of the subject. A lot of television presenting nowadays is about reading somebody else's words off an autocue and looking good as you're doing it. Men and women, by the way, I'm not being sexist there. Sports are a totally different thing because, as I say, it's almost always live. So I think you have to know what you're talking about because you never know when you may have to fill for 2, 3, 4 minutes and talk intelligently about something. So I think you've got to know what you're talking about. That seems an obvious thing, but an awful lot of people don't. I think a certain calmness under fire, an ability to stay fairly cool when, you know, hell is breaking loose and people are shouting in your ear and you don't know what you're doing next or where you're going, and just being able to keep talking and to keep things under control. Which, again, is not something that you can learn or practice for. It just comes with experience, I suppose. And as I said earlier, my radio training was a huge help there. I kind of instinctive knowledge of how long 30 seconds is, which seems a strange thing to say, but if they say in your ear, you know, 30 seconds to go, then you have to know, can I risk another question here? Is this the sort of person that will give me a short enough answer? Or will I just take the 30 seconds myself and what am I going to say in that 30 seconds that's meaningful? So all these kind of thought processes are going through your mind in a fraction of a second. And again, that just comes with experience. I don't really think appearance counts for anything. I suppose if you were absolutely horrendously ugly, then you wouldn't be put in television in the first place. I don't genuinely think you have to be an attractive person or dress well. I suppose voice comes into it. Maybe you have to have a reasonably intelligible accent. It doesn't have to be a very straight accent. It can be quite a strong Highland accent or Glasgow accent or any other kind of accent. And the X factor, which is something that Frank Buff said years and years ago, likeability. Now, I'm not claiming for a minute that I'm likeable, but I can see what he means. Likeability with a capital L, you have to have people watching the television who look and you think, ah, he seems like a good enough guy or a nice enough girl. I could live next door to them. I could go for a drink with them. I wouldn't mind spending 5 minutes in their company. And the really great presenters, the Des Lynams and people like that, I've got it in spades. You just know that Des is a good guy and you could happily sit and have a drink with him. And I think probably if you have that, and again, it's not something you can control or work at, because then it becomes false if you try to project yourself and, you know, try to be the comedian. Or I think that there's a falseness there which television tends to show up very easily. But if you've got that kind of X factor, then that, I think, probably helps too.
Can you describe what it's like to present an afternoon sports scene for you?
Afternoon sports scene, strangely, is the most satisfying programme to do in a professional sense. I mean, it obviously doesn't give you the buzz you get from, you know, being in the gantry at the Stade de France about to see Scotland-Brazil in the opening match of the World Cup. I mean, there'll never be anything bigger than that for me, I don't think. But in terms of professional satisfaction and professional challenge, something as straightforward and routine as the Saturday night football results, simply because we opt out of grandstand at whatever point, and usually the end of an OB. So we opt out, I say hello from Scotland, and off we go. And we have no idea where we're going, what we're going to say, what order things are going to happen in. It's totally live, totally unscripted. There's a running order, which is really just an offer to negotiate. I mean, we don't stick to it. You take reports in the order they come in. Sometimes there's a deafening silence and no reports are coming in because games have overrun or the guys can't get through or whatever it may be. So you really are just living by your wits, and hopefully you get through it. And it's also grown. It used to be a little 15-minute slot. Now it's expanded to usually about 35 or 40 minutes and takes in rugby and a whole lot of other stuff. And quite often you've got to hit back into network reasonably cleanly as well. So professionally, it's a huge challenge, not just for me as the presenter, but everyone involved, because the director's making up as he goes along as well. All the reporters have to contribute their bit, and sometimes the OB is told, look, we're really struggling here, we're underrunning, you'll need to get us an interview. So they're hammering in dressing room doors, trying to drag people out to be interviewed to fill another 2 or 3 minutes. It's just hugely satisfying. It's a strange way to get your kicks, but it's a great buzz. Compared to the Saturday night, which is the flagship programme, and I would never ever denigrate the Saturday night show. I mean, it's sports scene as an institution, and I'm hugely lucky still to be presenting it. But it's controlled and it's ordered, and, you know, it's the game's edited and you know what's going in it. You can script bits of it, not very much, but you do script bits of it, and everything's under control. So it's still a challenge. It's still live television. You still have to get it right. But it's not as frantic as the tea time one. Nothing like it.
The nighttime one also has kind of ETs that last about 15 minutes, so you do have that kind of
period
that you don't get in afternoon.
Uh-huh. And also, I mean, it's funny, I mean, my Saturday afternoon, I mean, obviously I'm sitting in there, and we have four monitor screens. One has the Vidi printer, which is how I keep up to date with who scored Berwick's equaliser at Albion Rovers. We have our outside broadcast and the two English outside broadcasts. In fact, we've got a fifth thing, we've also got the network, so if it's something like a big Six Nations rugby match, you're kind of trying to keep half an eye. So you're actually watching five or six screens, and inevitably you're always watching the wrong one. And there's three or four of us sitting watching it, and someone will shout, goal, or great shot, penalty, and you're, where, which one? So in a sense, I sit down on a Saturday night, and although I've seen the game in the afternoon, I haven't really seen it. I've seen bits of it, and, you know, I've seen their goals because they're obviously rerun, but I sit on a Saturday night, and you're almost seeing the game for the first time. And sometimes Gordon will come in, and he's been at a different game for radio than the one we have on Saturday night. So he'll come in about 6 or 7 and sit and watch the whole 90 minutes through, because he's obviously not seen it. So, you know, the two of us then start catch up on a game which I'm supposed to have seen in the afternoon.
Do
it's a strange way to earn a living.
Can you tell us how many sports you cover, firstly on a regular basis, and secondly throughout your career, how many different sports you covered?
Oh, I think that the last count was something like 25 or 26 the last time I worked out. And that, when you go to Olympics, as I've been lucky enough to do a couple of times, you tend to do strange sports that you wouldn't know. Man, I did the baseball in Barcelona, beach volleyball in Atlanta, which was wonderful. Gosh, I'd love to be a permanent beach volleyball commentator. That'd be all right. So I've done a bunch of different sports, just once or twice, a lot of them. The regulars, obviously, are football, golf, snooker, rugby, bowls, which I do bowls twice a year. And people still think I'm the bowls guy, and it's all I ever do, and I'm a passionate bowls fan. You know, I do bowls twice a year, and it's a lovely sport, and they're great people, but considering how much football or golf I do by comparison, but you get kind of tarred with that brush. It's a bit like Arthur Munford's sports jacket. You know, I'll go to my grave with people thinking he was the bowls guy. So those are the regulars, I suppose. And you still get the odd. I mean, I did the darts for a while, which was great fun as well. I had 5 or 6 years doing the world darts, which was wonderful.
Just sitting about in a pub. Do you think it's a strength as a presenter to cover a lot of different sports?
I don't know, it's not for me to say. I don't think I am. I mean, I think it's good for me. I enjoy covering different sports. Much as I love football, I don't think I would still be doing it 22 years on if I was doing nothing but football every week. Now, there are guys who are completely the opposite. They just adore football and they don't want to do anything except football. And there's nothing at all wrong with that. I'm a little bit different. Mm. I would get bored with it, I think. So I welcome the chance to get away and do golf or snooker, and I think it keeps me fresher. It gives you a slightly different perspective on sport, but you're just a little bit distant from it sometimes, and you see how other sports cope with things, and that sometimes helps you to deal with the sport you do most often. I think also being practical about it in career terms, I think it's probably quite a good thing too, and you do make yourself slightly more valuable to the BBC in my case. If they know that you're pretty versatile, and if they throw something at you, then you can probably cope with it. I always thought, in fact, again, it was Bill McLaren, I think, who said that in these times when sports rights are being won and lost on a regular basis, we've lost a few sports to Sky. Not as many as people think, but we have lost sports to Sky, obviously, and some to ITV. That even if you are Peter Allis, the greatest golf commentator in the world, or Bill McLaren, the greatest rugby commentator in the world, if the BBC, for whatever reason, lose all the golf or lose all the rugby, there's no job for them. They cannot be employed, even though they are the very best in the world. Whereas I like to think that, you know, no matter what the BBC loses, hopefully they'll still find something for DD to do.
Can you tell us what Des Lynam said about you and him kind of being the Dewey Thompson?
Oh, yeah, that was a great line, actually. It was a huge compliment, really, to Des, to say, you and I, Dougie. You know, what? But he's a great guy, Des, and like everyone else, I was very disappointed when he left the BBC. Understand why he did it, though. But no, Des said, we are the Dilly Thompsons of the sports broadcasting business. We're not absolutely world-class at any one thing, but we're pretty damn good at a lot of them. And I thought, that's a pretty good analogy. And, you know, I flatter myself that, A, I'm in Des's class, and B, that it's true anyway. But it's a nice analogy, isn't it? Mm.
What was it like presenting Grandstand for the first time?
That was one of the biggest buzzes of my career, I think. It really was, because Grandstand is the great British sports programme. It's an institution, and everyone who's anyone has presented it. And somebody pointed out 2 or 3 weeks when I knew I was going to do it, and I'd gone down a couple of times to watch Steve Ryder presenting it and just get a feel for how the programme worked. And somebody said, you know, you'll be the first Scot to present Grandstand. And I said, no, what about Bob Wilson? And they just looked at me and said, you'll be the first Scot to present Grandstand. So I said, well, you think, well, that's quite nice. That's quite something. It's what's in your own mind. I mean, I'm sure there are people thinking, what's the big deal about presenting Grandstand? Or why would you get excited about that? But as someone who loves sport so much and was never good enough to play for Scotland, that in my business, in the broadcasting business, I always equated to running out at Hampden. That's it, you've made the big time now. You are presenting the number one sports programme in the country. And yeah, that was a huge thrill.
How is it possible to have a depth of knowledge in such a wide range of sport? Is there a process you go through?
You just read a lot. You read a lot, you talk to a lot of people. I think one of the other techniques that you try to learn is, if you have an expert alongside you, then use them and know the line up to which you can go. Getting back to the Daley Thompson analogy, I know quite a lot about rugby, or quite a lot about snooker, quite a lot about golf, but I don't know as much as a guy who's played it at the highest level. So you can go up to that level and then let him take over, let him be the expert, let him convey his superior knowledge. It really is, it's just reading, it's watching, it's having a sympathy and a liking for the sport, I suppose, and talking to the right people and not being afraid to ask questions. There's a kind of slight professional pride involved in that. I mean, I'll sometimes watch a rugby game and I'll turn to John Beattie and I'll say, why did that happen, or why did they go that way, why did the referee give that decision? And he'll look at me as if, why don't you know that? And he'll say, well, I don't, I'm sorry, but you know, I like rugby and I know a lot about rugby, but I didn't understand that, so tell me. And I think you've got to be brave enough to ask questions when you don't understand. So it's a lottery. When I go away, for example, I'm away for, you know, a week at a time doing snooker or golf or whatever it is, my wife never throws out the papers. You know, I come back to this huge pile of newspapers which I plough through, because you can't afford to miss little things about who's signed for who and why so-and-so is not playing, or, you know, all the other little bits and pieces of the daily, especially in football, obviously, less so in some of the other sports. So there's a lot of homework, there's a lot of reading involved, but it's a labour of love. I mean, it's... funnily enough, I mean, when I went back, I talked about leaving university without my degree, and I went back 17 years later at the invitation of the principal of Strathclyde, who was embarrassed at me going about without my degree. And he was wonderful, and he said, look, come back, sit the exam, sit it properly, this one exam I hadn't passed, and as long as you pass it properly without any help, you can have your degree, which was wonderful of him. And I did, and I thought, God, after all this time, how am I going to be able to go back and study conveyancing? Because it had been so long since I'd done it. And I actually found it dead easy, because what I hadn't realised was I study every day. It's like a student. You study every day. You're studying football, or you're studying golf, or you're studying some other sport. It's still studying. It's still assimilating, taking notes, collating your notes, organising your thoughts. So actually, it was no different. So I managed to get the degree. So yeah, it's just homework. It's just preparation, and there's no substitute for it.
Would you ever swap being a presenter for being a lawyer?
Not now. No, not now, I don't think. I mean, I enjoyed the law. I never had any feeling like I don't want to do this. I would have been quite happy to go on and become some form of lawyer, but not now. No, I've had too much fun doing this, and I'd like to think Nabeeb might just keep me around for a wee while longer yet.
Moving on to the topic of bias, which is something we talked about the last time. Mm-hmm. Have you ever been accused of bias towards any particular team?
Not in a real sense, no. Occasionally, in the early days, not so much recently, but in the early days, you used to get letters. We knew your beloved Celtic had lost when we saw your big greeting face. I remember that one. And then you get one that says, we knew your beloved Rangers had won because you had a great big smile on Saturday night. And you all kind of think, well, if you get them in roughly equal numbers, then that's fine. I don't mind if people think I'm a Clyde supporter, whatever that means in terms of broadcasting. I mean, maybe if I was a Rangers or a Celtic supporter, I couldn't do the job I do. But I like to think that you would be professionally objective about it anyway. I don't have any great sympathy towards either side of the Old Firm. I admire both. I've worked closely with both. I've produced videos for both. I've had good friends in both, and I don't cry when either of them win or lose. The only time I'm passionately a supporter is when they're involved in Europe, same way as when Scotland are involved in anything. That's when you really are a supporter. On a Saturday night, if we've got Hibs against Kilmarnock, I really don't care who wins. I genuinely don't have any feeling. I know people in Bowen, you're happy for them or disappointed for someone else, but I think you have to be professionally objective. And I think it's a Rangers-Celtic thing among the fans. I think if you're a Dunfermline supporter, you're quite happy to accept that someone else is a Clyde supporter. If you're an Old Firm fan, I think there seems to be this assumption you've got to be one or the other. Don't tell me you're a St Mirren fan. You must be either a Rangers or a Celtic fan, really. I'm sorry, but don't be so arrogant. Don't assume that we all care so much about Rangers and Celtic as you do. Let me support my team.
Mm. Did the BBC issue any guidance on, you know, is it okay to be a Scotland supporter when Scotland are playing in the World Cup, but then if you're doing it for network?
That was the one in 1990. I got a row for that because I was reporting from the Scotland camp in Italy for network. And for BBC Scotland, obviously. So for to do the same report, if you like, twice, very similar reports. And for BBC Scotland, you can do we and us and be very partisan. And then when I did virtually the same thing for Network, I got a telling off the producer, we don't talk about we and us. Not because it's Scotland, England, or anything like that, just because we are professionally objective, and at Scotland are they and them, which is quite a hard thing to do. But then again, you do it week by week on a club basis. But when it comes to the international team, then you're not offending anyone by being a supporter. But the Network attitude is, even for England, even them and John Watson and the boys are told exactly the same thing, don't talk about we and us, it's England or Scotland or Italy.
Do you think that's something that the BBC continues to do better than like the likes of Channel 5?
Don't get me into criticising other broadcasters, because I might have to work for them one day. Not everyone has a different technique in doing it. I think when Sky came along, Sky still have a very small audience by comparison with the terrestrial channels, but their production values are very good, obviously. And I think, in all honesty, I think their production values have helped the BBC and ITV and everyone else, because suddenly people realise, of course, if you do have to spend a bit more money, and that was probably where it started, but you can do things so much better. You can put cameras there, you can have extra slow-mo machines, you can do this, do that. And I think that's helped all of us. Channel 5 tend to take more of a... I mean, Jonathan Pearce as a commentator, I think you either love or hate. I don't particularly like that screaming at the top of your voice style, because I've always felt that if you scream at the top of your voice from the first throw-in, where are you going to go if you get the goal of the season? You've nowhere to go. You've already been screaming at the top of your voice. So you have to balance it. And I'm not sure that that's his style. But again, there are people who say, John, it makes every game sound so exciting. It's fabulous. So horses for courses. Now, I think the BBC, I mean, obviously I'm going to say I still think we do it better than anyone. But I would say that, just loyalty to your employer. But I can appreciate other people's abilities, and there are people who work in other television stations I wish worked for the BBC, and there are people that work for the BBC I wish worked somewhere else. So.
Can you understand why the public are suspicious of the fact that no one openly supports, or none of them present the staff openly support Celtic or Rangers, whereas it's quite well known that you're a Clyde supporter?
It's a strange one, isn't it? I'm thinking, you said if 90% of the Scottish football public are support one or other of the Old Firm, why then none of the journalists? That's probably not true, because I think some people like Paul Cooney, Hugh Keevans, or Jerry McNee are all, you know, openly Celtic fans. Derek Johnson, openly a Rangers fan, but then again, he's an ex-pro, so I suppose he would be. I don't know quite why that should be. I don't know of anyone who kids on. I really don't. I mean, if you were to say to me, so-and-so claims to be a Dunfermline fan, but really we know he's a Celtic fan, I mean, I don't know of anyone. I genuinely don't know of anyone like that. I don't know what the answer to the question is. I think in the written press there are a few who are perhaps more partisan, but certainly broadcasting, I can't think of anyone. I mean, Richard Gordon, born and brought up in Aberdeen, supports Aberdeen. Rob McLean, born and brought up in Invergordon, supports Aberdeen. And so it goes on. I mean, Hazel Irvin, Dumbarton fan because she lives in Cardross. I mean, it's a kind of genuine thing. Maybe there's a link there, I don't know. Maybe it's because maybe you go into it, you become a broadcaster or a writer about sport because you're a supporter of a small team rather than a big team. I don't know. Seems strange, doesn't it?
Do you think the Old Firm are on TV too often, and can the BBC take the lead in that by saying, no, we're not going to have them on too often, or do they have to be drawn by what the public wants?
I think it's changed in the last 5 years. When I started, and because I'd come from Radio Clyde, which is a commercial radio station, and audience figures were all important because that determined what you charge your advertisers. So I always knew to the last 1,000 people how many people listened to my show in the morning. And every time there was a survey done, if the figures went up or down, then you knew. So I used to say to the BBC, how many watched on Saturday night? And nobody knew and nobody cared. I mean, that really wasn't an issue. And then somebody went and said, oh, there was 1.5 million watching. And I went, oh, that sounds a lot. Yeah, I suppose it is, really. I mean, there was no real, it wasn't a factor. Now, ratings are so much more important. Everyone's so much more aware of them. And sadly, Rangers and Celtic are the clubs you have to have if you want the ratings. And it'd be wonderful to be completely even-handed. And we still are. We still try to have a balance where every club is on, not as often as the other, but every club is on and is on 2 or 3 times, depending on how well they're doing. It'd be wonderful to say, no, we could be doing Rangers Hearts, but we haven't seen St Johnstone for a couple of months, so we're going to show their game in Motherwell. And that's a difficult one for the editors to call, because there's a temptation on both sides, and St John's and Motherwell fans pay their licence fee as well, and they want to see their team on the telly. But there are a greater number of people who would rather see Rangers and Hearts, so you have to accept that. I mean, Sky, for example, they don't even make any pretense of that they're about ratings, they're about big numbers, so they want Rangers or Celtic every week. And you can't blame them, they're a commercial organisation. The Beeb's a little bit different in that we are not commercial. We still care about ratings, but it's not the be-all and end-all. And the old cliche is that everyone else exists to make money, the BBC exists to make programmes, which is a wee bit facile. But there's still a grain of truth in that. And I think we genuinely do try to be as even-handed. Our cup coverage, I mean, we'd cover every single match in the Scottish Cup and get as much pleasure, I think, and kudos out of going and covering Berwick against Falkirk than going and doing the Old Firm.
How would you respond to allegations that football journalists and broadcasters in Scotland are fans with typewriters or fans with microphones, and do you think it's a bad thing?
No, I don't think it's a bad thing. I think you have to love the job and be enthusiastic about the job. It was always a criticism levelled at the Scottish press by the English press, wasn't it, that you guys are all fans with typewriters, in the sense that you would never be critical. And I think that's absolute nonsense now, particularly in the tabloids, who are constantly critical. I mean, I can't believe some of the stuff that the guys in the tabloids write or are told to write to sell papers. Everything is so sensational. And I mean, Rangers or Celtic are always, you know, two games away from a crisis. You know, it's just so over the top. But fans with microphones, yeah. I mean, only in the sense that you love what you do and you're enthusiastic about what you do, and you want to see good games, you want to see good players, you want to see good goals. And when Scotland are involved, you can show that. I mean, World Cup 1990, I was in the gantry with a tartan tie on because I'm a Scot and I'm a Scottish supporter, and I so badly wanted us to beat Brazil, as everyone did, and I was broadcasting to BBC Scotland. Had I been doing the network programme, I wouldn't have worn the tartan tie, because then you're perceived as, you know, you should be perhaps more objective about it. But I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, fans with typewriters, no.
To move on to Hampden, can you tell us what some of your memories of Hampden Park as a broadcaster?
As a broadcaster, scoring a goal in Cup Final Day, I never thought I'd be able to say that, pre-match celebrity penalty competition. Who was the goalkeeper? Alan Ruff. I think Ruffy was the goalkeeper. And I took penalties along with, you know, a member of Pan's people, and a couple of pop singers and stuff like that. But it was up at the Rangers end. I can't remember which final it was, but Rangers were certainly playing. I think it might have been Rangers Aberdeen in 82, thereabouts. So it was down at the Rangers, so this packed Rangers end, and I went up and scored a cracking penalty. I was saying myself, shit in the top corner. And there's this great roar went up, you know, this kind of semi-appreciative and semi-abuse sort of a roar. And I got a huge buzz out of that, to actually score at Hampden and Cup Final Day with a microphone on, so I was describing it as I was doing it, which was a bit of fun. But you know, going back from early days, going with my dad and standing watching internationals, and again, that great thrill when you suddenly ask, gosh, I'm actually playing some small part in this. Running on to the park in the early days to do the after-match interviews at cup finals and so on. The 1980 final, the riot final, and sort of running on to the park and realising that about 20,000 others had done the same thing, but they had a different objective than I had. And that was horrible, because suddenly there's police horses on and there's guys throwing bottles at each other, and that was one of the low points of my career, without any doubt. And obviously had a huge impact in Scottish football with the Criminal Justice Scotland Act and all the rest of it. So that was a downer that day, because I think we all went back. I remember back, we always have a party after Cup Final, a very subdued party, you know, after seeing these horrific scenes. I mean, shown around the world, Rangers and Celtic fans throwing bottles at each other on the park at Hampden. Dreadful. But then, since then, just great memories of great matches and great Cup Final. Motherwell and Dundee United in 91, which was, you know, I think everybody accepts, maybe the best final in recent years. Family final, as they said, and Kilmarnock Falkirk in 97. And I'm not sort of picking those because the Old Firm weren't involved, but I think you do get a different atmosphere when the Old Firm aren't involved, or at least not playing each other. I've always liked Hampden simply because of what it represents and the memories. And I remember as a kid, my dad sitting me down and saying, here's the greatest football match ever played, it's just come on TV. It wasn't live, it was at the 1960 European Cup Final, Real Madrid Eintracht, the 7-3 game, which again I'd been too young to remember, but the BBC must have re-shown it. This would be 5 years later or something, I suppose. And I didn't even know anything about it. And my dad sat down and sort of watched it with me. And that becomes one of your early memories of Hampden. And then you think you remember games because you've read about them so often and you've seen old news clips of them. So you suddenly remember or think you remember games in the 50s and the 40s because you've seen the pictures. And those huge swaying crowds. I remember being in Celtic Leeds, the European Cup match semi-final, which was 130,000. And I remember being on the terracing there. And, you know, your feet literally off the ground, jammed among all the shoulders, and the crowd swaying up and down the terrace, and you're just literally being carried along. And at the time, we didn't think an awful lot of it. You know, there were 130,000 crowds and six policemen wandering around the track. You think about it now, after the terrible, terrible tragedies that, you know, that happened at Hillsborough and at Highsall and so on, how that was ever allowed to go on. But we genuinely, I mean, I was with my dad, and, you know, he would always, you know, keep your head up and keep your shoulders up and all that sort of stuff. We just took it for granted. That's the way it was when you watched football. Now, thankfully, I mean, its safety is absolutely paramount, as it should be. But I have clear memories of that, definitely.
Can you tell us what you remember about the Hampden press box?
God, the old press box at Hampden. Smelly, dirty, never seemed to be cleaned. Sorry, Queen's Park, but... And the half-time teas, all the pies and the sticky buns up at the back of the... It was a two-tier press box. Terribly old-fashioned. And I always remember those old black Bakelite phones, which were still there right up until I think they knocked it down. Never terribly high-tech, but again, had an atmosphere all of its own. And just the climb up there and the view you had from it. Gosh, the view from the Hampden press box. I mean, because the overhang, you were almost over the touchline, you're almost above the pitch. Fantastic view of Hampden. And again, as a kid, I remember some of the photographs of Scotland-England games, which had been taken from there. So you've got this great elevated shot of goals, and it was always so much more effective than the low-down camera from behind the goal. So, the Hampden and the Ibrox press box, which was similar. Again, a huge climb to get up there, and this fabulous view you had looking down. And the Celtic press box, which is now the Sky box, now an executive lounge, which is the most plush. You know, it was carpeted and comfortable and padded seats, and it was definitely the most comfortable for a long time was the Parkhead press box. But again, as a kid, or when I first started broadcasting, just the thrill of being in there and listening to all the guys clacking away on the old typewriters and phoning in the reports, and just this great buzz of electricity about it. And then the uncertainty about who'd scored a goal. And you always think when you read a newspaper report, well, the guy saw it and that's how it happened. But what you don't realise is that, you know, and suddenly there's this buzz of corner. Who took the corner? Did the defence? Who scored? You know, and there's a kind of unanimity agreed upon. You know, there's somebody says, no, it was definitely McCoist or whoever. And you go, right, okay, it was McCoist. And the others are kind of an agreement that it was definitely McCoist, or that the defender didn't get a touch, or the goalkeeper did. And I was amazed by this, and I thought they all sat in silence and did their own interpretation, but they don't. There's a committee meeting after every goal to decide what they're going to say.
To talk about players in the media a wee bit, you've worked outside football, obviously. How would you say footballers compare in the way that the media treats them and the way that they treat the media compared to, say, bowling?
It's difficult. I mean, they get so much more attention than most other sportsmen, and I feel sorry for the players and the managers, because everyone wants a one-to-one. They do a press conference to 20, 30, 50 journalists, which can go on for a long time. Then all the broadcast media, every radio station, and there are maybe six of those, and there are every television network, and there are maybe another six of those. So somebody like a Kenny Dalglish or a Dick Advocaat, whoever, could end up doing, you know, 12 one-to-one interviews. And obviously the guys are asking pretty well the same questions. So he answers the same question 12 times and has to look interested and try and find a different way of saying it. So I do sympathise with the demands that are made on the big guys. But equally, I think football sometimes doesn't appreciate the enormous free publicity that it gets. Papers, television, radio devote column inches and hours of time to previewing football matches and reviewing football matches and basically helping to sell tickets. And for that, I don't think the media... I tend to take the broadcast media line on this, obviously, since I know more about it. I don't think we get quite the cooperation and the understanding that that maybe we should get for the free publicity we give them. Other sports would kill for it, and because I work a bit with the so-called minority sports, and they would kill for a hundredth of the exposure that football gets, and they are so cooperative, they will do anything for you. And I think football sometimes takes that a little bit for granted, and now that's why the guys are earning the fortunes that they are, is because this huge interest is created largely by the media. But there's the other side of it, as I say, where the time involved, and sometimes the media is also not fair to them. I know that, they take great exception that something that's been written or said, and can go into huffs about it. And again, I can understand that. And personally, I get upset when I always pull up a player or a manager if he says, "Ah, the media, I hate them." So wait a minute, don't give it this blanket media thing. If you hate a particular newspaper for the way it treats whatever you've done, that's fine, but accept that we're not all the same and we all have different agendas. I am not into sensationalism and transfer rumours and all of that. That's done by another branch of the media, so don't put me in the same category as someone who is giving you a hard time.
Talk about older journalists. Can you tell us some of the journalists that you remember reading or watching on TV?
Yeah, well, as a kid, when it was John McKenzie, the voice of football, in the Express, and Geir Henderson in the Evening Times, I remember. Alan Herron, dear old Alan, who I played golf with many times. Great guys, and great from a different era, I suppose, when the game was maybe simpler and there weren't so many members of the media. Alec Cameron, I mean, candid in the Daily Record, it was wonderful, but in those days there only were half a dozen Scottish football journalists, I suppose, and I think they probably had a pretty good life, really travelling around Europe, and I think they were much closer to the clubs as well. I think that's the other development recently, that the media are not encouraged to be as close individually and collectively as they once were. But I remember, and Jimmy Sanderson, who was just a legend. When he started in Radio Clyde, I was still at Clyde, and Jimmy had this wonderful, he was a great journalist, but he had a great showbiz attitude to it as well. And I can remember one day in particular at Ibrox, early days, I was there to do a match report, and Jimmy was sitting two or three along from me doing the match for Radio Clyde, and the team sheets came round, so everyone digested team sheets, and then you hear Jimmy on the radio, back to Richard Park it would be, says, "No, Richard, no, I haven't got the team sheets yet, but let me predict that Ali McCoist will return for Rangers today." And everyone in the press box is looking at the team sheet and knows that Ali McCoist is returning for Rangers. And they're all looking at me, Jimmy, who's giggling away and pointing at his headphones. And about 5 minutes later, then you'd hear him again, "Yes, Richard, we now have the team sheets. And as I predicted, Ali McCoist." And it was all just, it wasn't, he was being deceitful, I suppose, but it just made Jimmy sound great. And it was show business. It was just entertainment. And no one thought any the worse of him for it. And it sounded great in the radio. He saw football very much as a branch of entertainment. And he's sadly missed. He was, every phone-in you ever hear is a pale imitation of Jimmy Sanderson's and Radio Clyde. That's when it started. Jimmy was the first, and ever since then there have so many guys tried to do what Jimmy did, that kind of abrasive, argumentative, confrontational style, but always with a great sense of humour. And now you get guys who do it and it's purely confrontational and aggressive, and I'll not mention names, but you probably know who I mean, and people who try to do it and treat it all as a bit of a knockabout joke. But Jimmy managed to get the balance right between serious stuff and it was also fun. And it was absolutely compulsive listening to Jimmy Sanderson phone in and Radio Clyde. It started them all.
Can you tell us about the mendacity?
That was a wonderful day. That was Jimmy was having an argument with, I mean, there were so many jokes around that time about Jimmy. I mean, his catchphrase, one of his many catchphrases, because I think he spent most of it working on what was going to be his catchphrase that Saturday. One of his many catchphrases is, "When are you at the game?" And anyone who came on to criticise Paul McStay or whoever it may have been, Jimmy would say, "When are you at the game?" And if the caller admitted he hadn't been at the game, Jimmy just cut them off, because you had no right to pass any opinion if you hadn't been at the game. So there were always these jokes going about you know, a guy coming on and Jimmy saying, "When are you at the game?" He said, "Well, no, actually I wasn't. I was at my wife's funeral today." And there's a moment's silence, and Jimmy would say, "Well, it doesn't last all day, does it?" No, I'm sure he never said that, but that was the kind of jokes it used to go about. But this was a true one. Somebody came on and started accusing Jimmy, or making a point Jimmy didn't agree with, and Jimmy came up with a wonderful line, "Are you accusing me of mendacity?" And everybody in the studio, I'm sure, looked at each other, and everyone at home and in cars must have looked at each other, because nobody knew what mendacity was. And apparently, because I went and looked it up as everyone else did, it means untruthfulness. The guy was accusing Jimmy of, or Jimmy was accusing him of telling lies. And apparently he'd seen it in the Glasgow Herald crossword that morning. Mendacity, telling lies. And this poor guy there said, I don't know. Jimmy was a one-off. Jimmy was special.
Sort of only an excuse, quickly. What do you think of yourself when only an excuse?
It could be a lot worse, couldn't it? To my knowledge, have never said, can we go? No, we can't. But we Johnny and Phil Differ, who write it, come up with this as a catchphrase for me. They've always told me that I'm very difficult to do. For some, I don't know whether to be pleased about that or not, but Tony Roper said I'd go and Alistair McGowan said I'd go, and I don't think as an impression either are particularly accurate. They try to get the hair and, you know, all that stuff. Because I don't have catchphrases or vocal mannerisms and all that sort of thing, so they say. So I'm difficult to do as an impressionist. But I tell you what, I'd be very, very upset if I wasn't in it. Even if they're taking the mic mercilessly, you've still got to be. If you're ignored completely, then you've got a problem. So no, I'm a big pal of both Johnny and Phil's. I think they're hugely talented. Johnny's absolutely brilliant, and the catchphrases that he has created over the years for so many people, it's wonderful. No, I don't mind it at all. My God, if you can't laugh at yourself, there's something badly wrong.
You think it's the case that until you're on Only an Excuse, you haven't really made it?
I think that's probably true. Yeah, I think that is true, that once you're on Only an Excuse, then you're accepted as you're a major player in Scottish football.
Why do you think it is that in Scotland there is a kind of institution like Only an Excuse for footballers and football presenters? What does that say about Scottish culture?
I think it's just because of the unique place that it occupies in Scottish culture, doesn't it? I mean, football is such a huge part of it. I mean, other countries, I mean, rugby's a religion in New Zealand and South Africa, or cricket maybe in South Africa or the West Indies. But there's something uniquely Scottish about the way we accept our football, and we love it and we care about it, but we have this wonderful self-deprecating air about it as well. We don't really expect to win, and we almost glory in not winning. It just has and old grannies in the street who don't know, you know, an inside forward from a sweeper, but they know that Scotland are playing Brazil in the World Cup and they're going to watch it. I don't know whether it's healthy or not. There are maybe other things that we should be more excited about than football, but you're right, it's a huge part of Scottish life and culture.
Yeah, I just think it's amazing when it's like the dawn of a new millennium and what the BBC does, like a programme which is taking the mickey out of sports presenters.
I know, what does that say about us?
People don't know who Chick Young is, but they can do the Chick Young voice.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, Chick has become, God, I hesitate to say Chick has become a star, but Chick has become very well known, not through what he does particularly, but through Johnny's impression of him. And as Chick himself says, you know, Johnny Watson makes more money out of being Chick Young than Chick Young does. It's probably true.
Being a sports presenter has brought you a certain amount of celebrity status, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I would say almost to the extent of being a household name. There's not many people you could say Dougie Donnelly to and they wouldn't know who you are.
Oh, that's very flattering.
What effect has that had in your life? I mean,
touching wood, it's never been a problem. I don't take it seriously. I genuinely don't. I'm not claiming, you know, false modesty here or anything like that, because I know that I've been in telly a long time, and I know that people recognise you and all the rest of it. But thankfully, it's never really been a big problem for me. I've never had abuse or people giving me a hard time. It tends to be, again, that Scottish thing, they take the mic, and especially if they think you're getting a bit full of yourself, then they will immediately knock you down, and quite rightly so. So yeah, I enjoy it. I can't say it's a big thing in my life. I don't go out and look for it or get upset if somebody doesn't know who I am. But yeah, you just accept that it comes along with the job. But I think there are an awful lot of people in our business for whom it becomes far too important, and they become very aware of their perceived status and all that, and they get very precious about it. And I mean, we probably all know some of the people that I'm talking about. I'd like to think, in fact I would hate to think otherwise, I'd like to think that people don't think that I'm big headed or full of myself or think I'm anything special because of the job I do, because I don't really think that way. I mean, I've got a fairly healthy regard for my own professionalism. I think I'm good at what I do and I take it very seriously. I want to do it well, but I mean, it's only football, it's only broadcasting. I mean, it's not brain surgery or nuclear physics, is it?
What kind of ways would people take the mickey out of you. One thing Archie McPherson told me that was that he used to chant at him, Archie sleeps with Charlie, because he was so enthusiastic about Charlie Nicholas when he was with Celtic. So what kind of things people did take the mickey out of?
When I grew the moustache, that was clearly a major tactical error, that growing the moustache. I got always it's a stick for the moustache, which I think people kind of focused on. People always look for something to focus on. The hair, when I'm blessed or cursed with, you know, fair curly hair, and there's nothing I can do about it, but people kind of people latch on to that. And a certain furniture store in Tullycoutre seems to have, you know, it seems to be very important to people. I remember Alec McLeish still talks about this. We were doing Euro 92 and we had a platform right, and it was just sort of behind the corner flag where we were fronting the whole thing from. So there's me and a cameraman, Big Alec, who was the guest that day, and a floor manager, stage manager, and the whole massed ranks of the Tartan Army behind the goal. So we're literally 5-10 yards from them. And suddenly, they knew we'd go online. They can see Alec and I, Tom, previewing this game, which is going to kick off in about 15 minutes, live to the nation. And suddenly, the whole Tartan Army as one. I never know who starts these chants. There's obviously one guy who starts it, everybody takes it up. Suddenly, they launched into one Tullycoutre. There's only one Tullycoutre. And Big Eck just collapsed completely. It was the best advertising Sterling ever got, I think, you know. Just in Sweden, of all places, goodness knows what the Swedes must have made of this. Every member of the Tartan Army giving it one Tullycoutre. Wonderful.
Stop at foreign trips a wee bit. How many World Cups have you been to?
I've only been to two, 1990 and 1998. That was the only two that I've done. I've worked back here I think I did Argentina, Spain and Mexico, certainly I did from back here, but actually getting out to, because in those days, I think it was, again, it was the BBC didn't have very much money and tended to take a lot of the network programmes and just tag on maybe our commentator, but not very much in the sense of presentation. But fortunately we did Italy properly, as I would say, and I didn't go to 94 because we hadn't qualified. I was going to go with the network, but ended up not going because of some golf on or something. And obviously France in 98. But they're special. I mean, that's... I always say, even if we don't do well, and as we all know, we still haven't qualified for the second phase, which is one of my last great broadcasting ambitions, is to be there when we do finally qualify. But I always think, well, at least we're here. And there's always a lot of countries who aren't there. And 1994, which is the first time, as you know, we hadn't qualified for so long, it hurt. As it will hurt this summer when we're not at Euro 2000, and suddenly you're looking at your little kid with a nose pressed to the glass outside, and that's when it really hurts, and that's when people start to realise how important the international team is. And I've always said, and I would be thrilled to bits if Rangers or Celtic won a European trophy, but it cannot mean as much to so many people, excuse me, as Scotland doing well in a World Cup or a European Championship. It just means more to more people. And I make no apology for that, and as I say, I wish Rangers and Celtic every possible success. I'm thrilled for them when they do well, but it can't mean as much as the international team.
Can you tell us about, you mentioned that the media took the opening game against Brazil and France 98 pretty seriously. Can you tell us about that?
I think because it was a one-off, wasn't it? I mean, in our lifetime, I'd be very surprised if Scotland ever played Brazil, the world's number one football nation, in the opening match of a World Cup. I mean, it was just an absolutely one-off occasion. And the atmosphere at the Stade de France that day actually maybe wasn't as good as it should have been, because there were so many dignitaries and corporate guests there, and there weren't enough real fans, because the Scots and the Brazilians, as everybody knows, have this great empathy, you know, going back to Seville in 82 and during 1990. And it's a wonderful atmosphere when the Scots and the Brazilian fans get together, and there weren't enough of them that day, enough of the real foot soldier Tartan Army type. But for all that, and I can remember, there are not many times, because I'm fairly confident about what I do, I don't get very nervous, but I remember standing in the gantry that day, and I was with McCoist and Willie Miller, and just next to us in the gantry were Gary Lineker and Martin O'Neill doing it for Network, and we're all sort of standing chatting before we went live in our respective networks, and all of us saying, this is a wee bit special, this is a one-off, this is not the day to make a mess of it. So professionally there was a huge buzz about it, and to be absolutely honest, we didn't have that great a programme. Things went a bit wrong for us technically. And I ended up having to do commentary over the opening ceremony, which I was never meant to do, and hadn't really prepared all that well for, and felt I did a very bad job of it. And everyone else said, no, it wasn't, you got away with it, it was fine. But I watched the tape back and, yeah, it was never as bad as I felt it was at the time. But I was very, very unhappy at being put in that position. But, I mean, that's another story. But, yeah, when you get something as massive as that, there's a huge excitement and a huge appreciation of how lucky you are, together with an absolute terror of that being the day you do something terribly wrong. Because, again, somebody said to me, you know, this is a funny business we're in. You're only ever one four-letter word away from the end of your career. You think about that. You know, that's all it takes for my career to end this Saturday night.
Go on, do it.
I'd make the papers.
Can you tell us about the Tartan Army in St Etienne as well?
Oh. In the spring of 1998... two members of BBC Scotland Sport went out to St Etienne on a lovely summer day and realised there was a town square there, which would be absolutely perfect to do the live preview programme. And it probably was. It was a very attractive town square. So they decided they would do it, and they made all the bookings and all the lines and the local police and so on. So we booked this bandstand in the middle of the town square. And on a spring afternoon, I'm sure it looked absolutely sensational. The only problem was, when we actually came to do it the night before, we played Morocco. England were playing there. Which one did they lose? Was it Colombia or Romania? God, that's terrible. I can't remember now. But the one England lost, it was Romania, I think, wasn't it? So the Tartan Army were there in their thousands in the town square. Strong drink had been taken and England had lost. So the boys were partying big style. And as the England game finished, and then they looked over and suddenly all the lights come on. So this little bandstand, which nobody had paid any attention to, suddenly became the focus of, you know, 4,000 members of the Tartan Army's attention. And there's me and Gordon Smith and Willie Miller, with the camera crew and sound and the lights and everything like that, doing this live programme back to Scotland. And the boys quite rightly thought, oh, here's an opportunity for a jape. So they all gathered round and they were singing and they were hurling abuse, good-natured abuse at that stage, certainly. And then they started uprooting some of the plants which were round the bandstand and lobbing them at us. And I couldn't hear a thing. It's the most difficult programme I've ever done, I think, because I literally couldn't hear what was being said in my ear. I couldn't hear what Gordon and Willie were saying, and they were sitting literally, at, you know, 3 feet from me. So when we're into a VT, and I would say, after this, I'll ask you to talk about Colin Hendry or something, and the boys would go, okay, and then I would mouth something which they couldn't hear, and they'd mouth something back which I couldn't hear, and all the time I'm desperately trying to catch what the director's saying in my ear, and all you can hear is a Tartan Army singing in the background and things being thrown at you, and guys trying to climb onto the bandstand and security guys throwing them off. It was absolute bedlam. And at the end we got away with it just about, and people said it was wonderful watch back home, because, you know, they could hear the atmosphere, and it was all, nobody realised the panic we were going through.
At the start of the podcast, we asked you who the last player to score 4 goals in 4 consecutive games for the Scotland men's team was prior to Lyndon Dyke's recent feat. The answer is Colin Steen. Steen scored in 4 consecutive qualifiers in 1969. In total, he scored 9 goals for Scotland, including 1 game against Cyprus in which he netted 4 times. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Scottish Football Citizen. Subscribe to us on your favourite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. And join us again next week when we'll be looking back at more of the best of Scottish football from the past. If you'd like an extra football fix in your inbox every Tuesday, you can subscribe to Football Memories Scotland's weekly newsletter, The Football Special, and receive an email full of excellent pictures and stories from days gone by. To find out more, email Lindsay at lindsay.hamilton@scottishfootballmuseum.org.uk. The Scottish Football Citizen is written, edited and produced by Andy Kerr for Football Memories Scotland, in association with Alzheimer Scotland and the Scottish Football Museum. Additional contributions from Robert Harvey, Jim Orr, Lindsay Hamilton and Richard McBearty. Additional material from BBC Sports Scotland and The Guardian. This interview comes from the Scottish Football Museum Archive.